From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Within a decade of its launch by Aruna Abel in 1837, the Baltimore Sun was so dominant that the U.S. president learned from the Sun, not from the War Department, that the U.S. had won its war with Mexico. In the 20th century, the Sun was one of three daily newspapers FDR devoured with breakfast. A new book of recollections by dozens of Sun writers recalls the Sun's reach and independence. We talked to one of the book's editors and two contributors, including one who describes covering Black Baltimore as a foreign assignment. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to the On the Record podcast. You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
We're On the Record. Glad you could join us. I'm Sheila Cast. As an alumna of a great metropolitan newspaper, who would be writing still for the Washington Star if they hadn't folded it out from under me 35 years ago, I can testify that newspaper people love to reminisce about their journalistic exploits. The travels, the fearless questions, the implausible expense accounts, the fluid prose turned on tight deadline all make for great stories. All part of what the iconic Baltimore Sun journalist H.L. Mencken was reflecting on when he said in 1920, quote, "As I look back over a misspent life, I find myself more and more convinced that I had more fun doing news reporting than in any other enterprise. It is really the life of kings," end quote. Alumni of the Baltimore Sun have more to reminisce about, more to brag about, than most. Now, some of them have taken that Mencken phrase and made it the title of a collection of essays and reminiscences. The full title is The Life of Kings, The Baltimore Sun and the Golden Age of the American Newspaper. The volume was edited by Frederick Hill and Stevens Browning. Steve Browning is here with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Baltimore Sun alumnus and WIPR senior news analyst C. Frazier Smith. Frazier, hi.
How you doing there?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good.
Steve Browning, what is this book meant to do?
What this book is meant is to recapture a time when the Sun was a vital part of the Baltimore community. I'm not saying it isn't anymore. It's not a book of nostalgia, nor is it melancholy. It's really in an effort to recapture what the Sun was at a time which we call the Golden Age of American newspapers.
Well, let me pick up on that. As you say, you write in the introduction, this book is not a lament, yet it is hard to forget what has been lost. What should we be aware of that's been lost, in your view?
First of all, a bit of history, if I may. The Sun was founded in 1837 by Aruna S. Abel, an itinerant printer who came from Rhode Island. He quickly established the paper as a force in Baltimore and Maryland and in Washington, of all places. One of the technological advantages that the owners of the Sun enjoyed at the time was the B&O Railroad, which joined Baltimore and Washington in 1835, I believe, so that the morning Sun could be delivered in Washington at the same time the Washington papers were delivered to homes and offices. And the Sun was a better newspaper than any of the Washington papers, and it established itself for a very long time there. In the city, in the state, the Sun was a sort of the center of the civic conversation for a very long number of years. People picked up the paper. It became part of that day's conversation, part of that day's talk.
And you're really writing about and remembering in this book the time up until the Sun was sold in 2000, right?
There were two steps. The first step was 1986, I believe, when the owners of the Sun, who had held the paper for 150-some years, decided for their own reasons to sell the paper to the Times Mirror Corporation, which was a publisher of the Los Angeles Times, the Hartford Courant, and other Newsday, for the princely sum, I think, of $600 million. Then there was a falling out among the owners of the family ownership of the Times-Mirror Corporation, and they in turn in 2000 sold the paper to Tribune. And after that, within 8 years, Tribune was in bankruptcy, and it's had troubles ever since.
Fraser Smith, the chapter that Steve Broning referred to, that you contributed to this collection, was about covering the City Hall at a time when William Donald Schaefer was mayor. What is it that you want people to know about that experience?
Well, I think the importance of that chapter in the history follows pretty closely what Steve was saying about the Sun as a leader of public discourse in the state. It was undiminished in the years that I was there. And this story that I did about some serious problems that existed in the city that the voters had no knowledge of came along at a time when William Donald Schaefer was at his peak, probably, or nearing it. And there was no discussion ever in the newsroom about whether we should be concerned about taking him on, because he was very popular and very powerful. There was never any a word about that. And I think there are papers where the story that I did wouldn't have even been thought of, wouldn't have been considered. I mean, the independence of the paper was unquestioned. And I'm not saying that it is now. I certainly wouldn't say that now. But then, in the midst of what people and I and others call the Renaissance, here comes the Baltimore Sun saying, a lot of what you're doing is extra legal. It's beyond what the charter permits, and it ought to be well known. And that's what we were doing. That was our job.
Steve, the subtitle of The Life of Kings is The Baltimore Sun and the Golden Age of the American Newspaper, which implies that in some ways the Sun papers were typical or at least characteristic of newspapers then and not characteristic now.
Well, first of all, it was a business that made money for its owners and its shareholders. But what made the Sun and other newspapers like us so unusual and so important, I guess, was the freedom that we enjoyed. There were times, both at the Sun and earlier at the AP, where I would have paid them, at least in theory, to do what I was doing. It was so much fun.
What was your work at the Sun?
Well, first of all, I was the first op-ed page editor. I took advantage of the freedom, and I ran with it. I loved it. I love coming to work every day. And then after that, I went to Washington as diplomatic correspondent, where I had the honor to work alongside Bob Timberg, who died recently. Bob was the White House correspondent at the time, a brave and good man.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Steve Broning, co-editor of The Life of Kings, and with WIPR senior news analyst Fraser Smith, who was for years a politics reporter at The Sun. The Sun always had a reputation as a reporter's paper. Where did that come from? Is that, Fraser, do you think, typical of family-owned papers?
Well, for the two that I've worked for, that was definitely the case. The owners left the decision-making in the hands of the editors and were never second-guessed, even including things like endorsing for president. The newspaper made those decisions, and there was never any indication that there would be any other judgment except the ones that were being made by the editors.
This is not, as you said, Steve, primarily a lament. This is a book full of great stories. Do you have a favorite story?
Coming back to the Washington thing, I mean, this is probably overemphasized, but the Sun was so influential in Washington. In the 1850s, a man named Joseph Gale, who was publisher of the Washington Intelligencer, the oldest paper in the city at the time, was walking along the street one day, and somebody said, "Mr. Gale, what's the news today?" And Mr. Gale replied, "I don't know. I haven't yet seen the Sun."
I can't believe that actually happened.
It's in a book.
It's in a book. It must be true. You also tell a story in 1847, the Mexican War, that the Sun had organized such a good sort of Pony Express delivery system that it knew about the outcome of a battle before the War Department.
The Veracruz, which was the decisive battle for us against the Mexicans, A.S. Abel had set up this Pony Express system from the Gulf Coast, which would carry the news quicker than the War Department could carry it. And so that the Sun informed President Polk that the United States had won the war before the War Department told him.
That's an amazing story. You write about 9 foreign bureaus. This would have been in the 20th century. I'm going to ask Fraser, as someone who was covering local stuff, was the Sun's big emphasis on diplomatic and foreign coverage a detriment?
Not at all. In fact, it's one of the great. You asked what's been lost in the foreign bureaus, and we used to have 15 people in Washington D.C. We now have one. The paper started with Aruna Abel, who said, "I don't care about some letter between the National Bank and some politician. I want our paper to talk about what the significance of this might be for people in Baltimore." And he basically changed the emphasis of what the paper would be. And in doing that, chased about 6 other papers who were here when he got here out of business within a year or two. There was always the feeling that this was our paper. This was the newspaper of Baltimore and people that lived in Baltimore. I think that's still true. I think people are unhappy about how small it has gotten. And again, what we've lost is the reach that we used to have when there was a lot more money available. But this paper has tried, the current paper has tried to make accommodations for that.
Right. And Steve Broning, you praise the Sun in this book for doing a lot with limited resources these days. Where do you think things are heading?
I have no idea. I honestly don't. Nowhere good. The newspaper business has been crippled and brought near destruction with the arrival of the internet and other electronic media distribution. It's hard to compete with something like that.
I do want to get back to Bob Timberg, who died 2 weeks ago. I knew Bob Timberg during the period that is reflected in the chapter he contributed to the life of Kings, that is covering the Gipper, covering the Ronald Reagan White House. But you all knew him more than that. Tell our listeners something about Bob Timberg.
I think one has to begin by pointing out that he was horribly wounded in Vietnam, close to the time when he would have returned to the U.S.
He was not a journalist in Vietnam. He was a fighter. He was a Marine. A Marine.
And he had this horrible wounding where his face was almost
badly burned.
Badly burned, yes. He underwent something like 37 operations. And his wife said to him, I mean, he didn't know what he was going to do. And she said, I think you should be a reporter. And he said, I've never had a word published. And she said, but you wrote great love letters. So I think you could do this. And he adopted it. And he was very brave because one has to be honest about this. When you first met him, you thought, oh, my goodness, what in the world has happened to him? But one of the gifts that he gave us was that he had such a great sense of humor, and he loved to laugh. And you just, after a while, you just looked beyond what had happened to him. And so he really made it possible to have relationships with us, and we knew him really well. And if you see some of the things that were said about him by people he covered after his death, you see that he did the same thing in his job. So I think, you know,
it's a great loss. It is. Look, I appreciate you both talking to us about the life of Kings and reminiscing about the Baltimore Sun. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Sheila.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk to another contributor to the life of Kings about what it was like to cover Baltimore's Black population as a foreign assignment. We're On the Record. We'll be right back.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back. We're On the Record. We're talking about a brand new memoir of the Baltimore Sun. A memoir because a newspaper, in some sense, is the people who write for it. Since dozens of people who wrote for the Sun papers have packed their recollections into the book, I consider it a memoir. It's called The Life of Kings, The Baltimore Sun and the Golden Age of the American Newspaper. One of the most intriguing chapter titles is this, Foreign Assignment, Black Baltimore. That is Antero Pietola's contribution to this memoir. Antero Pietola, who reported for The Sun for decades and went on to write a seminal book about housing and racial desegregation called Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City. Antero Pietola, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
You grew up in Finland. How did you come to be a reporter for the Baltimore Sun?
I spent the summer of 1964 in New York. Then I went to back to Finland. Then I came here for graduate studies. And then the Sun...
Here meaning?
Meaning the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And so the Sun hired me against their best judgment. I was really a very strange applicant.
Well, you're talking about how you were strange, but also the picture you quote in this chapter, what you read as a college student in Finland, that Time magazine had written in its rankings of top U.S. newspapers. They wrote about the Sun, quote, "The paper remains aloof, aristocratic, old-fashioned, proud, and something of a snob, just the way Baltimoreans like it," end quote. Why did that make you want to even apply to the Sun?
Because I wanted a paper, I wanted to be a foreign correspondent, and I wanted a paper that, if I proved myself, would actually be able to send me somewhere.
Ah, so all along, as was true, I think, of many reporters at The Sun, your dream was to be in one of those overseas bureaus.
My dream was that I had been totally indoctrinated in Finland reading about journalism, and then in graduate school in Carbondale, Southern Illinois, I had been indoctrinated about freedom of the press and the people's right to know, and here is a paper that gave me that license. And when they offered me a job, I jumped.
And you said you were a strange applicant. Why do you think they hired you?
Well, they hired some very interesting people. There was a woman, and we had very few woman reporters, who was hired pretty soon after me. Her specialty was her attraction was that she had tried to climb the Mount Everest, and she wrote Japanese haiku. So, I mean, Scott Sullivan, who was the city editor and who hired me, he went after some very non-standard people. Some of them were good reporters, some of them were not, but they were very interesting people.
Non-standard. So you fit right in.
I fit right in.
You described The Sun when you joined it in 1969 as a police reporter as, quote, a time capsule.
It was. Quote.
What does that mean?
For instance, everybody certainly in the beginning was addressed formally, Mr. So-and-so. I remember this lady who wrote Japanese haiku. She came one day to the newsroom wearing jeans. She was sent home to change.
That was into other slacks or into a dress?
Into a dress.
Into a dress. I remember those years. Not at The Sun, but elsewhere. That was the year after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
That was.
And Baltimore was one of the cities that had erupted in violent protest. How did that affect you as a reporter, a new reporter at the Baltimore Sun, or did it?
I guess that in retrospect, the only thing that it did, it made me even more curious about the city and the conditions in the city. Now you have to remember the starting point. When I came to The Sun, and now I have to make distinction between the two papers, The Sun was separate from The Evening Sun, separate reporters, separate editorials, everything. The Sun, when I came there in 69, the year after the riots, did not have a single black reporter. So the city was open to whoever wanted to cover the city. And so we were handicapped, and I saw an opening there, and I was interested in an American city. I was a foreign correspondent. I had no fear. I went anywhere. And so so uh, But the city was very demoralized after the riots that came after a couple of decades of white flight, and then businesses also were fleeing. So it was a very, very strange city.
And were the editors of the Sun, the higher-ups, interested in your making a beat out of understanding the dynamics of Black Baltimore?
They were interested and they welcomed it, but at the same time, since they did not know anything about it, they were kind of jittery about it. I mean, who is this kid? I mean, he comes from Finland. I mean, can we trust him? That is the only thing that really mattered for the Sun was, are you going to be a reporter who won't embarrass us?
That was a standard the Sun set for all its reporters.
Right.
And it was applied to you in this case. So give us a couple of highlights of how you then pursued this interest.
Presence was one thing. You would go, and if you went to interview people, if you went to cover an event, people were mostly gracious and receptive. They were kind of wondering, well, why is the Sun here? What is this in for the Sun? But, I mean there was no real tension. This was at a juncture in the civil rights movement, though, when in the aftermath of the riots, the character of everything changed because Black nationalism was on the rise. And so gradually, this kind of hospitality that I detected in the beginning, it became far more guarded.
You and Mark Reuter, the talented Mark Reuter, who now writes for Baltimore Brew, did a series together on housing discrimination.
Yes.
How did that go?
We took a stretch of Baltimore that typified desegregation in housing, including blockbusting, intentional panic building. And that was Liberty Heights Avenue. Well, it was the Liberty Road section of Liberty Heights Avenue. And that had been a stretch of Baltimore that in the early years, in the 1920s, had barred every other group except for white Christians. Then Jews came to portions of that stretch in the 1930s. And then in the aftermath of the riots in 68, blacks started moving to Liberty Road in Baltimore County, starting with Luckern. And so what we did, we kind of looked at the Baltimore County stretch of Liberty Road and what was happening there. And what we saw there were the typical earmarks of blockbusting and panic, forests of for sale signs, clearly people fleeing.
In 1979, you wrote four parts, a series on the Black power structure of Baltimore.
Yes.
It's not fair to ask you to give us the highlights of a four-part series, but is there a thumbnail sketch you can give us of what you covered?
I tried to identify the people who were the power brokers, and chief among them was William L. Adams, he started as a numbers runner and then became a political power, and then he became the first truly important African-American businessman in Baltimore.
And financier for some
financier,
other
yes.
entrepreneurs.
And when I started the series, I had a bias against politicians. It was my belief that politicians come and go, that I wanted to really try to find some other powerful people whose power base was not in politics, which they could not truly control.
You think you did that?
I think so. I mean, it's kind of interesting that one of the people that I profiled in the series and interviewed was Kathy Pugh, who is now the mayor designate. And
well, she has to go through. There is an election to be held, but yes, she is the Democratic nominee. Did you have any qualms as a white guy from Finland profiling the Black power structure of Baltimore?
I did not. I mean, for me, being a reporter was being a reporter. As a foreign correspondent, if I go to Russia, I don't worry about being among Russians.
When your chapter heading describes Black Baltimore as a foreign assignment, is this about you being a European looking in on this, or is this about somehow introducing the paper's readers to an element that was foreign to them?
It wasn't about me at all. It was not about my background. My readers had no idea who I was or where I came from. It was my attempt to try to bring some understanding to the structure of how power was exercised in the Black community. So as a result, I then was sent to South Africa. He had explained it in Baltimore. He's going to do a pretty good job in South Africa, too. And then the same in the Soviet Union.
So covering an element of Baltimore that the Sun had not been covering with much sophistication actually did prepare you to fulfill the dream that you started out with.
It absolutely did, yes.
I really appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Antero Piedla, a contributor to The Life of Kings, The Baltimore Sun and the Golden Age of the American Newspaper. Earlier, we spoke with another Sun reporter, now WIPR senior news analyst C. Fraser Smith, and Stevens Broning, co-editor of The Life of Kings. Tomorrow night, Broning and Fred Hill, the other editor, will speak about The Life of Kings at 6:30 p.m. The free event takes place at the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped at 415 Park Avenue. It's part of the Pratt Library's Writers Live series. We've got information on the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for being with us on The Record. Tune in tomorrow. We'll be discussing how secure your vote is. I'm Sheila Cass. See you later.